This week in Retronauts, we take it back to the beginning. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts. I don't know what number this episode is going to be because it's not actually on the schedule. It's going to slide into the scheduled DMs, just, you know, in a sort of shifty, shady kind of way, because that's what we do. We're here as Retronauts, Retronauts East. I am Jeremy Parrish. Did I say that before? I might have. Who else is here to take up the slack for me? Because I'm already, I feel weird not talking directly into a microphone. We're trying the socially distanced pandemic lav mic setup where we can all sit like 6 feet apart instead of being up in each other's faces for when we take, you know, Retronauts on the road in the future. And I feel like I need a microphone directly in front of me to focus. Otherwise, I'm just like, yeah. I'm just having a conversation. This is terrible. It's already weird. Off to a terrible start.
Yeah.
Save me, Benj.
I'm Benj Edwards. I was just saying it's
this
funny.
This whole podcast is resting on your shoulders.
Yeah, it's funny because now it's like we actually have to talk to each other like face to face.
I know, right?
The microphone in front of us. Yeah, we have these lapel mics. So anyway, yeah. Benj Edwards and
Ben Elgin. Yeah, first time using these new mics. I mean, I finally got used to like the webcast mic that I had for the pandemic, but it's not here anymore.
And finally,
I'm Chris Sims, and this ain't my first rodeo.
So you're comfortable with this?
Yeah.
You're going to be your usual self.
What else could I possibly be?
I don't know. It's been more than a year and a half since we have recorded together in person.
It's been a minute.
No, actually, it's been quite a bit longer than that. 19 months,
minute.
Actually.
Yeah.
You're doing the millennial minute. Zoomer
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, that's me.
That's you.
Me. Good old Zoomer Chris.
Zoomer Chris. We're all Zoomers these days. This is the first Retronauts episode we've recorded not on Zoom in a very long time. And as such, this may also, I don't know, this may be the last time Retronauts East is able to record in person like this as well. So with that in mind, I wanted to throw aside the plan that we had for this episode, which was to talk about a specific game and collection and history, and just go kind of casual and talk about us, basically. I'd like for us to talk about the games that turned us into people who like video games, our favorite games, and the games that, you know, we first encountered when we were but tiny children and made us say, ah, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to play video games. With that said, I feel like that's pretty much what the past 15 years of Retronauts has been for me. So I don't know that I necessarily need to go into a lot of detail about this, but I would love you gentlemen to share your recollections. And also, I put out a call on Twitter for people to write in. I thought, you know, it's a day before the recording. I'm probably not going to get a lot of responses, but I was mistaken, and we got something like 35. So we're going to kind of interweave community responses with our own comments and just kind of make a casual hour and a half of it, if that works for you guys.
Sounds great to me.
Mm-hmm.
So with that said, let me ask you, Chris Sims, who is authentic and has been to many rodeos before.
Correct.
What was the first video game you played where you said, hot damn, this is it. This is the thing.
You know, I've been thinking about that since we decided we were going to do this as the topic. And it's really tough for me to figure it out. Because as a kid, like, I mean, I made the joke earlier that we're all of the age where it's just like, yeah, it was Super Mario Brothers. That's the end. but there's a lot of truth to that for me, because I remember playing my aunt and uncle's Nintendo as a kid, and then they wound up getting me one for Christmas, I think, the year that I moved to South Carolina after my parents got divorced. So I was really looking for something to fill a void in my life at the age of 5. And that, I think, like, Super Mario Brothers and, like, seeing all that there was to see in it really did do something. But the more that I thought about it, the more that I realized that it wasn't as much a specific game as it was Nintendo Power. Because that would be what I would get in the mail, and then I would go to the rental store every week, because we didn't really own that many games for the NES when I was a kid. We had Mario Brothers, we had Tetris, we had Dr. Mario, and I got a copy of Tiger Heli at a flea market. And I'm pretty sure that's all I ever owned for NES. Hmm. But I played everything by renting it on a Friday after school and then read everything in Nintendo Power. And that's how I missed out on playing like Metroid until I was an adult, because I could never...
That predated Nintendo Power. Yeah. Nintendo Power would have occasional like, here is a secret tip for Metroid, but the actual coverage of Metroid predates Nintendo Power, yeah.
Yeah, and when I think about the games that I really loved, like Mega Man and Mega Man 2, Mega Man 3, and DuckTales, which I've talked about as being like one of my all-time favorites and one of the all-time best games, like the memories that I have are often... Like for Mega Man, it's less playing Mega Man and more reading that one Howard and Nestor where Howard put an arm cannon on, and I was like, that's the coolest thing I've ever seen in my life.
A man with a bow tie and a hand
and an arm cannon. Shooting needles out of it.
Bonkers.
Amazing. So thinking about that, and like I used to get the like special strategy guide that you could get as a subscriber where it had like all the Mega Man games, all the Zelda games. And
those were gorgeous. There was a Mario one. Yeah. I love those. I've still got them somewhere.
Like, just pouring over those maps. Like Star Tropics was in there, which I tried to play when I got the NES Classic. And I was like,
had to be there.
Thinking about this is a lot better than playing it. So for me, that was it. And then as it progressed, the more I started thinking about it, the more I was like, oh, that was probably also my first real exposure to manga. When they got Shotaro Ishinomori, the creator of Kamen Rider, to do the Legend of Zelda comic and that great Mario Brothers comic that also ran for Mario World. It was a big part of my childhood just reading that magazine and then playing the games associated with it. Like, the games were never not there, but in a lot of ways I feel like they were secondary to the experience of knowing about things, which I feel like has been a definite pattern throughout my life of wanting to know everything about something.
Yeah, I don't know if the Nintendo Power experience you're speaking about is something that can really be explain to kids growing up now, because we have so much access to any kind of media, any kind of information. Like, we just go online and it's there. And, you know, you're talking about wanting to know everything about something. There are sites just dedicated to, like, what is the thing you want to know about? Do you want to know about SNK fighting games? Well, here is a networked wiki that just has every possible bit of information about these games you can imagine. That did not exist at the time. So, you know, getting these magazines, especially Nintendo Power, because it was so focused on just Nintendo stuff and just on really on the, like, the games that they said, these are going to be big, we should really promote these. There was something very immersive about the, you know, just pouring over those magazines and, you know, looking at those hand-drawn or screenshot maps and just imagining yourself playing the games. And sometimes the games did not live up to that.
Yeah, Castlevania 2 was not that good, actually.
I was thinking more of games where, like, the jump physics are really bad. So you look and you're like, oh, that looks so cool. But then you play it and it's actually kind of miserable.
Yeah.
So there were kind of like the games we invented in our heads. And then when something came along that was actually as good as that, it was great. It was like, hey, this is it. This is exactly what I thought it would be, or better. I did not expect this. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I felt betrayed by Nintendo Power several times because of that. Because I would rush out and rent the latest cover game. And I remember something like Bayou Billy or something was not that great. You know, I rented, that was on the cover one time, and I was sort of disappointed with that.
I had that experience.
They had some of the, you know, it wasn't always, and I hated how they'd use licensed games, which I really didn't like that much. I don't remember what in particular, but, you know, some movie license or some cartoon license or something. Those games to me weren't as high quality as some of the other games out there. And did you have that black player's guide, the Nintendo player's guide?
I got one down at the office right now. Mm-hmm.
I love that. Like, that was like my Bible, because you could, it had maps in it and everything, and it just had all the games and a big list. And it did have that sense of you could know everything about this platform in one place. And at that time, it was relatively comprehensive because this is like really early in the Nintendo's lifespan. But yeah, I mean, I had the Nintendo Power experience too. We had it since issue one. My brother got the Nintendo Fun Club News or whatever. Is that what it was called? The precursor?
The Fun Club News.
Yeah, the Fun Club News. We got a couple issues of that when he subscribed. And then it switched over to Nintendo Power. And yeah, it was amazing. I don't know what it was about it. I think you just have to be that age where you can absorb and imagine anything. And it's very real to you when you see illustrations and they get translated in your brain to really visceral, real things. And there's something about, I don't know how, like, what's that thing where you feel or like you see colors or you, you see sounds or you hear.
Yeah, synesthesia.
You know, whatever. Yeah, synesthesia. I may have been a little bit like that when I was a kid because I remember looking at the pixel art in that Black Player's Guide and sort of like feeling the texture of those images almost. And I thought it just felt good, you know, somehow. And I love the black box designs with the pixel things and how they're uniform. Anyway.
Yeah, like digging into the player's guides and stuff, it was our generation's wiki diving, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, even if it was something where you knew you were never going to actually get and play this game, it was cool just to read about it and to explore its world without even having to, you know, invest in that game. You still get to, like, see what's there and just and go exploring with the maps and stuff. You know, it's the same kind of impulse that, like, as a kid I would pull, like, a natural history book off the shelf and just look at animals and places and stuff. And it's the same thing, but for someone else's fantasy world.
Yeah. And I in my experience, today's children, kids these days, still have that drive, that desire to learn about a thing, to experience a thing without actually participating in it. Like, I have a nephew who really loves Minecraft, but he doesn't play it nearly as much as he just watches Minecraft videos online. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, Five Nights at Freddy's or Undertale or whatever. It was like a year before he played Undertale, but he knew everything about it because he watched all these Undertale videos and fan theories and things like that. Like, he played the music live at a concert on drums. Wow. And I think, you know, that was before he actually had access to the game. So yeah, like that still exists. Like, things still mm-hmm. spark that imagination and drive kids to want to know more about it, to want to make that a part of their worlds, part of themselves, even if they don't necessarily have access to it. So I think, you know, our experiences are still, as I think about it, relatable.
It was. Yeah. Oh, I was just gonna say it's a good point that it's not just our wiki, but also our Twitch. Because this was basically the closest you would get to, like, a lot of these in-depth articles in Nintendo Power and in the Player's Guide. It was basically as close as you would get to watching someone else, like, play the first quarter of the game.
Howard and Nestor was a pair of frenemies doing a Let's Play.
Doing couch commentary,
How has Nestor not come back as a Twitch star?
Oh, God, yeah.
Nintendo, what are you doing?
VTuber.
Yeah, he should. He should be a VTuber. Yeah. I mean, he would be.
It was also, for me, like, a very economical way of experiencing the most that I could. Mm-hmm. Because, again, I feel like there is such a hard divide culturally between, like, people who grew up and didn't have the internet until later in life and had, like, Blockbuster versus people who didn't. And you would go to the video rental place on a Friday, and you'd essentially get, like, one movie and one game, and you had that for the weekend. That was your weekend. Mm-hmm. So if you got a bad game, you would just play it because that's what you had for that weekend.
I had a friend who sometimes rented two games at a time.
Why?
I was like, you are out of control. What
Such
are you doing?
Decadence.
Is he an oil baron? But reading Nintendo Power, you obviously, if you got the good game, you would want to rent it again next week, right? But if you had Nintendo Power, you could read about all the other games and have that imagination experience. And like you said, have the experience of experiencing media without indirectly, which I think is something that has carried through not just culturally with younger people these days getting into Twitch, but like also me as an adult. Like, am I literally ever going to play Tokimeki Memorial in my life? No, absolutely not. I feel like I would hate it. Have I watched a 5-hour YouTube video about Tokimeki Memorial? Yes, I have. Multiple times. I'd like to have it on more.
You know, I grew up watching my brother play games, too, because he's 5 years older than I am. And that was like my Twitch. So
yeah.
I experienced a lot of games just watching them. And I felt like I was playing and taking part because I'd suggest things like, go this way, do that. Here's how you solve that puzzle and stuff. It felt like playing it to me, which is funny. So
It was like Twitch Plays Pokemon, but
yeah,
a little like you could actually reach out and slap them.
And that was also the
like college dorm experience for me. And that would be like Nintendo 64, PlayStation era, but we had like different things set up in different people's rooms. And I definitely like watched other people playing stuff at least as much as I actually played things.
I feel like all of us probably had the experience of being friends with a classmate that we didn't necessarily like, but who did have that oil baron money to own video games. I did. Maybe I'm a bad person, or was when I was 10.
It's relatable.
But I do feel like that was, and I don't mean this in like a gatekeeper-y way, but like an obsessive way. Like that, I feel like, was the dividing line between the ubiquity of the NES and being someone who was like into this like ersatz culture of like, oh, this is going to be a thing that I'm going to do for the rest of my life. Very much like with comics, very much like with wrestling, all the other like subcultures that I ended up gravitating to as a kid, largely because they were full of stuff that I knew. And I've talked about this with the X-Men. I had the feeling when I was a kid, oh, I'm never going to understand this because there's always going to be too much of it for me to get my head around. And that was very appealing for me because I would always be able to learn new stuff. And I felt that way with video games, and I felt that way with pro wrestling, and I felt that way with comics. In terms of actual games where I'm like, oh, this is what did it. Again, I'm sorry to be like super basic about it, but it kind of is the 1-2 punch of Mario 3 and Mario World. Like those were the games that I had. Like I did own Mario 3. Never owned Mario 2, but I did own 1 and 3.
You jumped straight from Tiger Hele to Mario 3.
Exactly. Which, you know, if you get good at one, you'll be great at the other.
They're almost the same game, really.
Tiger Hele is not cited as an influence on Mario 3 as often as it should be.
You know, in Yoshi, Super Mario World 2, Yoshi's Island, there's a helicopter stage. So that's true. You could play that pretty well.
I think Nintendo repeated the same mistake a couple times in its lifespan as a company, which is that the best game for a system was the one that came with it. And they did that with the Super Nintendo, and they did that with the Wii. Where, why aren't people buying more games? Well, you gave them Mario World, and they're...
That's why you had to buy Mario 64 separately.
Yeah, that is. That is exactly the thing. But yeah, like I feel like those games are so good. And also, Mario 3 was like a cultural event, and I got that one. And then Mario World came with the Super Nintendo, and I would rent, games, but that was the one that I had at home. Like, if we had a summer where money was a little too tight to go rent video games every week, I just played Mario World until I could do it blindfolded, like all 96 with the little star.
I did. I remember memorizing many of the stages in Mario World and playing them over and over again and just trying to do it perfectly sometimes because I just had nothing else to play.
as an adult, either on an emulator, but I think it was when I got the SNES Classic, like I went to the special stages, and I was like, oh, I could do these when I was a kid, and it was hard, but I could do it. And as an adult, I'm like, it's been an hour. I'm not through Tubular yet. I'm done.
Yeah.
Like, I do not have the reaction time or the patience for this.
You know, it's really weird. When I go back and play games from when I was a kid, sometimes games that I thought were really hard back then, I'm just like, oh, this is nothing. This is easy. Like, this is so easy. And others that I thought were pretty easy, I'm like, what was I on? What kind of drugs was I taking? Like Battletoads, I can't do that. Ninja Gaiden 2, I destroyed in a weekend rental. But now I go back and play Ninja Gaiden 2, and I'm like, oh, how is this humanly possible? What's wrong with me? But then, there are other games where I go back and I'm like, why did I think this was so hard? This is nothing. It's really weird.
So I actually just got my hands on a Super NT recently. So I busted out my Super Nintendo collection. Of course, the first thing we popped in was Super Mario World. Started playing two-player back and forth co-op, and it's still a lot of fun. But it is really interesting, like what muscle memory comes back and what you remember and what trips you up. There's definitely some stuff to breeze through, and other stuff I'm like, wait, what's going on here?
Okay, this is funny. I have two kids, and I think I've joked about it in another episode where I would ground my kids and then force them only to play retro games or something. Well, last year I tried that. They were playing something for too long, like Minecraft 10 hours a day. I'm like, you got to stop for a while and take a break. But you can play, I'm going to hook up an NES in your room and you can play it as much as you want, And so I got Super Mario Brothers 3 on there, and I was showing my kids how to play it, and they're like, Dad, you know where everything is. How the hell do you know where that is? Like the secret blocks and this whatever. I'm like, you have no idea. We played this over and over again for years. You know, this is what we did back then. And so they were impressed. So I got to show off my skills.
Finally a hero to your kids.
Yeah.
That's what it takes to bridge the generational divide, Mario 3.
They couldn't fathom that I knew all those things and remembered them. Even Super Mario Brothers 1, I mean, just where the secret, like where the star is, you know.
The one-up mushroom right at the start.
Yeah.
The ghost houses in Mario World were a really dividing point. I'd get in one of those and I'd be like, okay, wait, I remember the trick to get to the regular exit, but where the heck was the other exit? I don't know.
Yeah.
Like every other game that I can think of as being a favorite that came out later, like I don't think I would have loved as much if I hadn't loved those first and if I hadn't been obsessed with the reading about them first, which then, you know, turned into, in the late 90s, getting into reading about video games online, which turned into buying a copy of The Anatomy of Castlevania, which turned into me sitting in this chair. So it's a pretty direct line, honestly, from Howard
Mario 3 to this episode.
From Howard Phillips putting on that that arm cannon to me sitting in your living room.
Fair enough. All right, so that was Chris Sims' thoughts. Now I'm going to read a few letters, just to kind of leaven things a little. Not that this has been heavy, but you know what I mean. Just to kind of mix things up. From Pete Shoemate, the game that made me fall in love with games was, surprisingly, the Atari 2600 version of Pac-Man. I know now that it isn't good or even tolerable by most standards, but it was the first game my dad and I played together. We'd play together on Sunday mornings before church. The game allowed me to spend time with my dad and introduced me to the joy of sharing games with people.
There's a lot to be said for context, even if the game isn't that good.
It really is. Like, there are, we've already talked about it, there are favorite games from when I was a kid that I have gone back to and been like, oh, this is bad. Mm-hmm. But, like, the memories I have of it, like WCW NWO Revenge on the N64, not a great game, especially compared to the stuff that came out like immediately after, but the summer that I spent playing that every day while also listening to a Sam Kinison album over and over, that was a weird month of my life, let me tell you.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of this really corny habit my father-in-law has. Whenever we eat out and it's a really nice meal, and if someone says, I hope you liked the meal, he always says, the meal was okay, but the company was better. It's hokey, but like I get the sentiment behind it. I feel the same is true with video games. Like playing a game with the right people and in the right circumstances can make it seem like there's something more than what's actually there.
And that, I think, is the core to the popularity of stuff like Let's Plays and stuff like Twitch streaming, is that it's that parasocial hangout.
Well, I wasn't thinking that necessarily. I was thinking like actually hanging out with friends.
Yeah, no, but you know, especially over, you know, in the past year, Jimmy, I don't know if you know, it's been a hard year.
It has been a little rough.
Like I feel like that parasocial aspect has, cannot be understated.
I have a comment on that a little bit, which is that the idea of which games are good and bad is a new thing. Like, well, new as in the last 15 to 20 years. Before that, when we didn't have this universal place where everyone could go read about what games everybody thought were the worst and stuff. So when the internet, you know, the web was coming out and stuff, there were no websites where people were talking about this stuff really. And then I think one of the defining moments was reading one of Sean Baby's websites, which I mentioned several times, and how he hated on Deadly Towers, for example. And I love Deadly Towers. I mean, it's a terrible game, but I love playing it. And so just having someone out there cementing that idea in the culture that other people could access, that sort of spreads and makes Deadly Towers, quote, a bad game. And the same with Pac-Man and all that stuff. That didn't, you know, lots of people loved Atari 2600 Pac-Man. A lot of people loved it. There were bad reviews of it. it was not a great port, but I had some of my brother's friends loved playing Pac-Man on the 2600 because they didn't know any better, and they were just, they loved having the experience of playing that at home on the only console they had. And so it wasn't until, you know, some writer or historian came along and wrote down that, oh, Pac-Man is why Atari...
It's probably Stephen Kent.
...folded. Yeah, it's either Stephen Kent or Leonard Herman or something. You know, one of those Phoenix rise and fall Atari kind of things. You know, it. Those are just cultural ideas. Everything is an idea. Like, I have an opinion on a game, I'll write it down, and it becomes... Other people repeat it and spread it, and that's just an idea. It doesn't mean it's true, you know. So whatever you love and whatever you enjoyed is your truth, and that's fine.
I don't know. I think, and Jeremy, I don't want to speak for you as a professional critic, but no, I think those are completely accurate and objective truths that everyone should pay attention to and go to Patreon and support monetarily.
Yeah, the phenomenon you're talking about is something I definitely experience a lot with my YouTube videos. Whenever I cover an NES game. Mm-hmm. That the angry video game nerd has produced a video, you know, content about saying, this is the worst game ever. Like, there's always just a stream of people coming in who I have to assume they just click around YouTube looking for games that the angry video game nerd has panned so they can go to those videos and just repeat his jokes and, like, basically rehash everything that he said, which, you know, like, he has a thing, and it's funny and was successful for him. It's been successful for him for a long time. It's made him very well liked and very famous, and that's fine. I don't begrudge that. But I do get frustrated by people who take what is very clearly meant to be a bit by him and are like, ah, yes, this is the objective truth about this video game. It is truly terrible, and I must, you know, venture around the internet. What's the opposite of white knighting for, you know, against this game? Just anytime I see a video about it, I have to go comment on it and talk about how terrible it is and repeat jokes. Like, it's tiring.
I'm sure you've had this happen to you, which is that sometimes, I mean, if you've been writing long enough, people will come back and correct you with your own information that you introduced. Yeah. And that's like crazy. That drives me insane, but it happens, you know, and.
I don't exactly get that, but I do get where I'm, you know, researching a topic for Retronauts. Uh-huh. And so I started the Wikipedia page just to, like, kind of get a baseline before branching out into other articles and videos and that sort of thing. And I'll be like, okay, what are some references here? And it's like, oh, Jeremy Parrish. Yeah. that's not helpful.
Yeah.
I need some outside opinions.
So you heard it here first, folks. Jeremy Parrish says Jekyll and Hyde for NES, number one game of all time.
Absolutely. So from PC 98 Audi, for me, it would be Another World, known as Out of the World back in the day. Prior to discovering it on the Amiga, I had played games on the NES, C64, and MSX, and obviously loved them and enjoyed all the various experiences across genres and platforms. But Another World was the game that made me think very much beyond the screen, so to speak, by immersing me into the world, making me analyze my surroundings in great detail. Imagine the society and history you never see, and the actual sense of friendship with Buddy, the alien, made me emotionally connect with the game unlike any other before, and in many ways, since. I was about 10 or so when the game came out, but that was the game that made me decide I wanted to work with video games, and still to this day is the game I credit for actually achieving that goal. But the real answer is Bubsy. So this actually cements a theory that I've had, which is that the greatest game of all time is whatever you played when you were 9 or 10. Uh-huh. And I think this conversation and these mailbags will bear this out. All right, I'm going to do one more here from Angel S. Here is a stupid story from a country where it was tough as balls to get video games for a long time, especially original ones, especially if you didn't live in the capital. I was 5 to 6 years old. One day, while playing in the yard of the kindergarten on the other side of its fence, there came 2 to 3 older kids with these notebooks over which they had scribbled arrows and letters. I kept hanging around them, but on my side of the fence, and of course, eavesdropping. What I understood was that the scribbles were codes for a game called Mortal Kombat. Prior to that moment, I might have seen some computer games, Moon Patrol or something, played a bit of Tetris, but nothing so mysterious. So this memory of secrets, rumors, codes, and the act of knowledge being passed between the kids stayed with me for maybe a few years until I started going to school, and next to it was a burger place with a Mortal Kombat 3 arcade. And I finally saw the thing that those codes were for. Of course I loved it. Of course I was getting my ass kicked on the game because I was a kid and didn't have the cash for coins to practice because post-socialist Europe, Eastern Europe in the 90s, not the richest years, you know. However, that stuck with me for another couple of years until I finally got a Sega Mega Drive and my friends bought me a second-hand cartridge of Mortal Kombat 3. I'd literally spent most of my summers basically playing two-player mode alone, entering the combat codes for both players on my own until I saw every single finishing move, every combo, every bullshit that was possible in the game. Sorry if this came in too long, but this is how a fire in my heart was sparked that still burns to this day, for better or for worse. Much love from Bulgaria.
Very cool. Yes. Yeah, codes were amazing, and the transfer of knowledge between kids, like tips and things. I may have told this story before, but when Mortal Kombat came out, I had a CompuServe account, and people were posting the fatality things on there. So what I did is I would download them and then change, like, I'd write some kind of pseudonym on it, like the Combat Master or whatever, and I'd print it out and take it to middle school and pretend I had thought of them, like, or I had, like, an inside source, you know, from somebody else, and I was really popular for 1 year because of that.
This is like the same sort of thing we were just talking about and wanting to like explore all the things about a thing. Like I've never been that great at fighting games, but sometimes it's fun to just try out all the moves and see them and find out all the combos and find all the special finishing moves and just even, you know, play against a two player that's not there like he was doing. So you can just do them all and see them all and see all the cool things that are in this game that you might even not get to see if you were playing it for real, because someone would just kill you before you got there.
Well, I think that letter also got back to what Chris was talking about with Nintendo Power and so forth, of mm-hmm. like not necessarily having access to a game, but being aware of it and being like fascinated with its mysteries and, you know, the arcane secrets that it holds. Just, you know, when you finally get a chance to experience that for yourself, it really does, you know, it felt like this culmination, like finally this thing that I've desired so much, this thing I've wanted to do to experience. You know, I've trained in my brain for this day, for this moment, and it's finally come. Like that has a great impact. That's very profound. Like, I think for me, that was probably maybe Zelda 2. I don't love that game necessarily, and I know it has a lot of flaws, but it took so long for that to come out. Well, and Castlevania also, like getting my hands on those NES cartridges, I coveted them for months and months. Mm-hmm. So when I finally got my hands on them, I was like, hell yes, this is the good stuff.
They were great at the time. They're hard as heck, but I loved them. I mean, I mostly watch my brother play them because they're too hard for me. But even now, I'm getting off tangent here. So yeah.
Well, tell you what, let's go on to your tangent. What would you cite as the game that made you stop and say, "This is the thing. I love video games."
Gosh, that's hard to say. I have a sort of complicated answer that I actually just realized listening to Chris talk about his experiences, is that when I was a kid, I didn't think that I loved video games until I was about 12 or 13 or something like that, because I didn't think I was good at them, and I didn't think I was like a game player, because I was judging myself against my brother, who would play a game to obsession, to completion, no matter how difficult it was. But if a game was very difficult for me, I would get frustrated and I would give up, basically. And so there were a few games when I was, you know, under 12 that I would actually play a lot. And in retrospect, I did actually play a lot of video games. I mean, what happened was when I turned 12 and 13, I started to look back and say, now I can finally go back and actually beat Zelda by myself, or try to beat Metroid by myself, or try to beat Zelda 2 by myself or something. And so I didn't think that I liked video games for a long time. I wanted the kids to go play outside with me in the woods. They were always in front of their TVs. They were like, "Let's go inside and play DuckTales or whatever." And I'm like, "No, please come on, play in the woods with me." You know, but the first games, you know, I've probably talked about before, are I love Donkey Kong on the Atari 800, and the Seven Cities of Gold I mentioned on the Atari episode was a very deep experience watching my brother play that. You know, this is before the NES, because it was just a whole generated world inside the computer you could explore, and it was amazing. And then I also remember Super Mario Brothers really, the first one, really broke open everything for me because it was very magical. It had secrets and things, and I remember talking to my dad, having a conversation at one point about Super Mario Brothers. I was like, "Dad, how do they actually make video games? Like, how do they make it so you can control something that's on the screen? You know, because it felt like witchcraft or black magic or something weird that's like something you have no fathom. If you have no idea about computer technology or whatever when you're, you know, 8 years old or something." I had no clue how it was done. He said, well, it's actually a type of computer and they can program it and they do this and that. I'm like, whoa, that's the magic. Like, you read books about magic your whole life, like how you actually make the magic, and there's a device that lets you make the magic. You craft your own world with your own rules, your own physics, your own artwork and universe and everything, and it's interactive and you can play with it, and that's incredible. And as an aside to that, you know, I wrote a history of about Space War from 1961 a few years ago, and how that was like the first time man had ever really created a virtual world they could inhabit through vicariously through an interface, or they could move around a representation of themselves on a screen in a world. And up until that time, humans had always been telling stories to each other, like around a campfire or whatever, and imagining these things in your head. And for the first time, we could put that world into something else, a device that would render that world for us and let us experience it and inhabit it. And that was like a groundbreaking moment in humanity. And that was the dawn of video games. And I feel like when I asked my dad that, he was like handing me a key to a forbidden kingdom of knowledge, like that you could... it's possible to create these types of games and, you know, make this magic, you know?
So which game would you say specifically caused that? Was it Seven Cities of Gold?
Super Mario Brothers was when I really realized what games could be, because I was finally old enough. I think we got an NES in 1988, so I was 7. But there were so many, you know, I had so many game experiences on the Atari 800 before that, and so it's hard to say. But yeah, I'd say a couple things, like Seven Cities of Gold really was mysterious, but I never thought about how it would work and things like that until I got a little older. But yeah, as boring as it is, it's like another Super Mario Brothers moment, probably.
I mean, that's not boring. There is a reason that is considered a landmark video game.
Yeah.
And it really was a revelation at the time. I mean, I was someone who played a lot of arcade games, in the early 80s. But even so, Super Mario Brothers was really impressive because it was like an arcade game, you know, visually and in terms of just how well it played and how much content there was to it. But you could play it on a home console, and it made the NES like super desirable. I mean, everyone wanted an NES and they wanted to play Super Mario Brothers because it was just like, it was hard to believe that that was a game you could play at home.
Well, it was on top of that, it was such an expansive world because like even in the arcade, a lot of the games were just like a screen or a series of screens that you'd hit one at a time. And now this, you know, Super Mario comes along with having these huge side-scrolling worlds and lots of them. And it's just the scope to it is so different from almost everything that we've been playing before in terms of just imagining exploring this huge space.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The fact that there were secrets hidden on purpose in that game blew my mind. Like you could get to the warp zone or that there were hidden mushrooms and things like that. And everything was great. The fluidity of the controls, the graphics, the music. It had background music. I mean, I came from a place where most of the games didn't have background music, you know, on the Atari while you're playing because there weren't enough audio channels, things like that. So, yeah, I mean, that's, you know, there were other PC experiences, but that was like, I think, 91 or so, 1990-91 when I was playing PC stuff, so...
All right, let's read a few more of these letters from Blake. While my early years were spent playing my dad's and television games and visiting the arcade, I can pinpoint falling in love with video games to when we picked up a copy of Metroid on NES. I distinctly remember turning it on for the first time and truly feeling a sense of atmosphere by the visual design and incredibly evocative soundtrack. It was different than the simplistic games I had played up to that point. I spent months drawing maps of each screen on notebook paper, trying to figure out where I was going, and remember also working on it with my dad. This ended up causing me to do the same thing in games like Eight Eyes and Legacy of the Wizard, two games we bought later. This experience drew me in to being fully invested in video games and the industry around it from that point onward.
It's actually pronounced 8-E's.
8-E's is underrated, super underrated game. It's hard.
I never liked it. I wanted to like it because it was so Castlevania looking, but then I played it and it was like, wow, I actually think I hate it.
There's a couple elements to 8-E's to me, which is that one is I have a good memory of playing it with my brother. That's why I rate it higher than other people would. Because the second player could actually play that little hawk thing that flies around, or eagle, or whatever it is. It's amazing. And then, yeah, it's got cool graphics, but yes, it is difficult, and it's not that great of a game. But I still think it has that edge because of you can play the hawk as a second player that sort of elevates it against other, like Castlevania clones.
It is the second best game by the creator of Sokoban. The first being Sokoban.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Thinking Rabbit was a developer.
This also touched on another big part of the whole exploration and digging into things we've been talking about from this era, which is drawing your own maps, that I think sucked a lot of people into a lot of games when you just had to, you know, you had this big world and there wasn't all that information out there and you just had to plot it out for yourself. Obviously lots of people have that experience because, you know, you get things like Etrian Odyssey tapping back into that well of, oh, it's kind of cool to plot out your own map.
Yeah, I would just like my brother's navigator when he was playing. I could help draw the maps and things. And I mean, the games then, when else can a kid go on an adventure like that other than a video game where you feel bigger and greater and more powerful than you are and you can explore new places? So that was like a incredible fantasy world. It reminds me of people like my dad's generation talking about reading who's that?
Boy's
Life. Boy's Life or like a Hardy Boys type things, and you know, Tom Swift or something, like where they would imagine an adventure. But we had that fantasy adventure, but it was interactive. It's really neat.
Yeah, so in Metroid, if you fall into a pit, you can get back out and you're okay. Whereas if you do that in the woods, there's probably going to be trouble. But yeah, I mean, I've talked about this a lot over the years on the podcast, but Metroid definitely has that sort of foundational formative experience for me. And it was because of, you know, like, wow, here's a game that is so big that I have to draw a map to make sense of it. That's so full of secrets that I have to really just experiment and explore, get lost. It's like, it was just, you know, so much more immersive and so much more of like an actual space than any video game I had played before. Even, you know, like computer type adventure games. It just, there was nothing quite like it at that point. So it really had a huge impact.
Yeah, Metroid was amazing. The secrets, I remember discovering you bust a false wall and that just blew my mind.
Chris, you're a fan of Metroid, right?
A little bit, yeah.
Did you play it back on NES?
No, I never did. I never played Metroid or Metroid 2. Or Super Metroid.
What?
Until very recently. it was the Game Boy Advance ones. It was Fusion and Zero Mission that really got me into it because I had already been into the Castlevanias. The Castlevania.
The Castlevania. That's perfect.
I did go back. They're very good.
You played Super Metroid. I think I remember you talking about playing Super Metroid for the first time. You know, a few years ago.
A couple years ago. That game's good.
It is.
It is known.
It's a master.
It might have been mentioned on this podcast before.
I don't know if you've heard, but Super Metroid, pretty solid gaming experience.
Yeah. Environmental storytelling is what I like to say about that. How it unfolds the story without having to talk to you or spell it out or whatever.
Yes. It's a shame that all went away for Metroid Fusion. But I think Metroid 5 seems like it's going to be a shut up and fight kind of game. We'll see.
I was disappointed by Fusion as well, just because of that.
I like Fusion, but yeah, you have to go into it with a different mindset than Super Metroid. If you expect the sort of terse, like, wander around and get lost experience, it's going to disappoint you. If you expect it to be sort of this subversive, like, it seems like it's hand-holding, but then you escape and do your own thing, that's cool. Anyway, here's a letter from Lucien Hoare. The game is Attic Attack by Ultimate Play the Game. I'd seen arcade games back in 1983. I'd seen Space Invaders, Missile Command, Pac-Man, etc. I'd played Combat on my uncle's VCS. I loved them all. But nothing changed my life like Attic Attack on my friend Toby's original rubber-keyed ZX Spectrum. I visited him and he showed me the latest game from Ultimate Play the Game, later Rare Limited. I didn't understand what I was seeing. A tangible, colorful world that you could explore with a myriad of strange creatures in your way. Secret passages that you would change depending on which of the three characters you chose at the start. There were wells you fell down, caves to explore, Frankenstein, Dracula. Your life meter was a roast chicken that slowly revealed the bones underneath as you got hit. It oozed personality and charm. It was fast and fun. And when I got home that night, I talked my mom and dad's ears off. I remember standing in front of their bemused faces as I described everything I'd seen. My proto-TED talk must have worked, because they got me my own ZX Spectrum soon after, and I loved it more than anything. Attic Attack showed me that games weren't just shallow, arcade-like experiences. They could be whole worlds filled with exciting adventures, filled with exploration. The types of games I love to this day.
Yeah, that game looks cool. I've never played it, but I just never
heard
it
of
up.
That game.
I've heard of it, but because it's a Spectrum game, it's never crossed my path. From Stuart Smith, if there is a single game that could be noted as why I fell in love with video games, it would undoubtedly be The Legend of Zelda on NES. I was about 5 or 6 years old at the time and barely had any idea what a video game even was. My only previous encounter with the medium that I can remember was an arcade cabinet with Hogan's Alley on it at a pizza place. So walking into my friend's house in the afternoon on Christmas Day to see him playing Zelda on his brand new NES was nothing short of a revelation. I'd never seen anything like it, thanks to its colorful graphics and unique monster designs. Though I had no real idea what it even was, I knew that my friend was controlling what was happening on screen, and I knew that I, too, had to play with it as well. I just turned 40 this year, and my love for the medium remains as strong as ever.
I have a memory about Zelda I don't know if I've ever mentioned. But it's just, it doesn't mean anything to anybody but me. But I remember going to see my grandmother in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. We'd go see her every spring break or something. And she had this ancient TV set that was probably from the 60s or something at that time. This is the late 80s.
Was it one that sat on the floor and was in a wood console?
It was actually on a 1950s type metal stand with like a glass panel on the front. And it was crazy. So it wasn't quite the floor console thing, but it... So we hooked up our NES to this because it was our new thing and my brother's obsession. And so we brought it with us to Tennessee. And we just spent that whole trip playing Zelda on my grandparents' TV while my grandma was watching. And she was born in 1907. So I had no idea what she was thinking about this. She's like, oh, this is amazing. You know, oh, what are you doing? You know, on the screen, can you play it? Can you do it? You know, and she was slow. She didn't talk with that speed, but it was just incredible. I remember that game swirling around my head while my parents were trying to drive us around the town and show us landmarks. My brother and I were in the back seat talking about Zelda, you know, the whole time. It's a memory.
Here's one from Andy, who says, I was presented with an NES at 3 years old from my very loving and well-meaning grandparents, who were also gifting it to my parents, who were 24 and 21 at the time, respectively. While my dad was obsessed with Super Mario, I zeroed in on a 3-pack that included the disappointing TMNT, the utterly baffling Totally Rad, and the sublime Bucky O'Hare, which was the first game I found engrossing, but could not play. This was upended a year later when I caught vision of the 16-bit glory in my dad's friend's Sega Genesis and what was liquid cocaine itself, Sonic the Hedgehog. I used to run around with my siblings playing Sonic, but we were still very young and engulfed in transmedia properties and marketing. The first game I truly fell in love with was Shining Force 2, accessed via Sega Channel, a quest for someone who had never even played an RPG presenting. It's so epic and so different from anything. I was creating epic battles across our tiled floor with my action figures. Amazing what bright sprites can do for you. Growing up in California, it's funny to see how different my experience is to my new home in the United Kingdom, or with my partner who grew up in Greece with PC games as her primary introduction to the medium.
What a cool way to play it on Sega Channel, all things. It's neat.
All right, we'll go one more letter before jumping over to Ben. From James Crisley. The one game that made me fall in love with games as a whole was probably Super Mario Bros. 3. I had relatively young parents, and one of the benefits of that as a 3-year-old back in 1991, didn't we just read this letter? Was having access to the many of the different NES classics, including the Mario trilogy. Mario 3 just floored me with all the different worlds, different stages, and secret after secret that I was still discovering even decades after I first played it. The letters from Princess Peach, rescuing the kings of each land, the mind-blowing nature of everything being huge in Giant Land, the Koopa Kids, it was the most epic adventure you could ask for. Not to mention the great power-ups, like the Tanuki suit, an extremely rare Hammer Brothers suit, and the weird ones like the magic whistle in the music box. It was, and still is, one of the greatest games ever, and I'll still fire it up once a year just to play through it again. Not to make this long love letter to Mario 3 even longer, but thanks for all the podcasts over the years, etc., etc. Okay.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening.
I feel like the Hammer Brothers suit ruined a generation of people who play video games. Because, like, that is the reason that, like, there is a certain demographic that will always hit the end of a game with, like, 99 potions that you haven't used because you might need them. Because you only get that Hammer Brothers suit, like, twice. And you're like, and if you get hit once, it's done.
Yeah.
It's so cool. Mm-hmm. But you just can't get it again.
Yep.
I did
ruin us.
Mm-hmm. It did ruin all our lives. No, I remember that feeling. But that's why the Game Genie was so special, because you could have infinite Hammer Brothers
suits.
Yeah. So
I feel like that's, you know, playing kind of not the way the game was intended.
That's the whole point of the game.
Well, they should have intended it better than
So you're saying it was a deeply flawed game, is what you're saying.
Deeply flawed.
It's like starting Grand Theft Auto with a tank, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the only way to start Grand Theft Auto.
Hmm. Sounds like fun, actually.
Let me tell you about a little thing called Saints Row you might enjoy.
Here's a very short letter from Andrew McLean. The game that first made me fall in love with video games and music too is Super Mario RPG Legend of the Seven Stars. That's it.
Yeah, that's
I appreciate
game.
The brevity.
And it had very nice music.
That's the first RPG I liked. Because RPGs were one of those things where, again, I would read about them in Nintendo Power. And look, I'm a nerd. I like fantasy and swords. But, like, I tried Final Fantasy when I was a kid, like Final Fantasy 1, and it was not for me. It was not the game I liked.
It did not spark joy.
But then Mario RPG, probably because it was a Mario game, you know, I gave it a shot. And, like, that is what hooked me into RPGs as a genre, was that bridge to it.
He also, in his one sentence, mentioned the music. I think that was the first big Yoko Shimomura soundtrack we got over here, which was very nice.
Unless you're counting Street Fighter 2.
Oh, well, that's right. She was on that, too. So, very different kind of music.
Fairly popular.
Yes.
Somewhat successful.
Right.
Good music, too.
Right.
I used to play...
Different kinds of good music.
When Street Fighter 2 came out on the Super NES, I would just sit and listen to the music. I hooked it up to my stereo, and there was a music test mode in the options, and I would just play the music like over
crank up Guile theme. Da, 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 da.
Yeah. Yes.
So we also slid Street Fighter 2 Turbo into the Super NT recently and played it for like an hour. And I'm like, oh my God, how did I do this without destroying my hands?
You had little baby calluses back then.
I had such cramps after just trying to play
Street Fighter. You've gone soft from your analog controller.
Yeah.
You need a BX Foundry BX110.
that is exactly what I need.
Only someone still made those.
Yeah. I can make one for you.
That is exactly what I need.
I got enough parts, I think.
So, we're going to roll into the final segment of this. Here's another letter from Matt. Some of my earliest memories involve my very early years spent living above the bar my mother tended. As this was circa 1984-85, there were obviously a few arcade machines hoping to catch a few quarters from the sauced patrons, one of them being Dragon's Lair. In that dark bar, it lit a special place in my mind. the feature quality animation, and booming attract mode shining to my eyes. The perfect bait to lure me in. I would spend the hour or so before the bar opened pretending to play, my head just high enough to see over the control panel. Despite not being a particularly good game, it still remains as a fond memory, largely defining my love for games and animation.
Cool.
So, Ben... Sorry, go.
I'm just saying, that's neat, because that game was punishingly difficult. Quick time event stuff, but that's a neat...
It was meant to siphon those quarters out.
Dollars.
Don Bluth needs that money.
Yeah. Anyway,
left his Disney paycheck. He's got to bring in the bucks.
Secret of Dim didn't get him as much as he wanted. Yeah. Give me that Dragon Slayer money.
Secret of Nim was great, though. Should make a Secret of Nim game. I don't know what you'd do with that. I don't know.
Would you focus on the escaping from the National Institute of Mental Health stuff or the rats having sword fights stuff is the question.
Why not both?
Both, clearly, yes.
The 80s. You don't have that kind of space.
You could have four totally disconnected mini game events with totally different play mechanics, none of which were any good.
Now I'm envisioning this Prince of Persia in the Institute of Health, sword fighting rats on your way out. There you go.
What if there, I know there was Space Ace, but what if there had been a slew of Don Bluth games? What if he had the Anastasia arcade game? My question.
The Fievel Goes West arcade game.
Great.
All right. Did I say we were going to talk to Ben? Well, I lied. Yeah. One more from Shoshana. There's a lot of letters here. I got into games a bit late as there wasn't much money to spare in my younger years, but eventually, we kids got Game Boy Advances for Christmas, each with a game. I got Dragon Ball Z, Legacy of Goku, and it's not a very good game. But it was one of the first games I got to sit with for longer than a few hours at a friend's house, and I didn't have the perspective that it could be bad. All I knew it was that it was a game, and it was hard. So when I saw a trailer for the sequel, and you could play as other characters aside from Goku, I had to have it. After mowing some yards and getting the money together, I sat down to play, and within 5 minutes, I knew the first Legacy of Goku was bad. This new one controlled so much smoother. The combat was slicker and felt better. The level design didn't make me want to rip my face off and throw it at someone. Legacy of Goku 2 taught me the games could be a joy to control, to beg you to explore them and reward those who do. And it had a completion reward. For most, it's just another Dragon Ball Z game, but for me, it was a glimpse into what games could be. And despite all the changes in my life, I still have the original cartridge with all the lessons it taught me.
I don't remember if I've played that one or the second one, Legacy of Goku. I've played one of them, and I thought it was pretty good, so it must have been
probably
the second one.
Yeah.
So I feel like this is probably another, a totally different episode. But was there ever a game where you realized, oh, games can be bad?
Yes. I know exactly the moment it was for me. It was Taboo the Sixth Sense, which is not actually a game.
It's not a game.
I loved that, though. I rented that and loved it.
I rented it.
I believed it. I believed it. I thought it was real, because I was a little kid. I was like, man, this is talking to me. It's amazing. Telling fortunes, all this stuff. Anyway. But yeah, Athena was horrible. I remember renting Athena on the NES, and my brother and I were like, this game sucks. Now I think some people may like it. I don't know if so. I'm sorry, but at the time we thought it wasn't good, and we were appalled at how bad it could be.
It really is pretty wretched. But the box art is very nice.
Yeah, that's what drew us in, I guess.
All right, Ben. What was the game that made you fall in love with video games?
So I wanted to put a little bit of a twist on this, just because I was also an NES kid, so I had all these same formative NES experiences as pretty much all of us here. Although I did jump in with Super Mario 2, because that was the point at which I'd save up enough money to buy myself an NES with my allowance money. So I maybe have a little more attachment to Mario 2 than other people.
It's a great game.
It is. It's a good game. And it's another one that just has, all these huge worlds to explore with lots of secrets and stuff.
I think it gets
lots of corners to explore.
I think it gets a bad reputation for being weird, but objectively on its own, it's a really good game.
It's also a really good Mario game.
Yeah.
It's just different.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Mario games were always different back then.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a great game. Delicious.
It is, but so that was great. But I also wanted to talk about the games and game systems that made me feel and Ben scooped me on this a little bit, talking about what goes into making a game and the magic behind it. But the places where I got glimpses of things you could do to make a game, And that started out probably on the Texas Instruments TI-99-4A that we did an episode on, because I had one of those. And that was one of the systems that was kind of straddling the line between being a game playing system and being a home mini computer. And so it had BASIC on it. You could program. But there was kind of a disconnect between the two sides on that one. Because, you know, you had BASIC, you had these magazines that would come out with like BASIC programs you could type in. But as the name implies, you would mostly do really basic things with those. You could do text-based things. You could, like, maybe print out a square room in ASCII and do some things and print out some graphics. But then on the other side with the cartridges, it had more arcadey games, you know, Tombstone City. It had a Pac-Man knockoff. It has a Space Invaders knockoff. So you got some idea of, like, how stuff was made, but you couldn't really make the games you were playing on the game side yourself just with, like, the basic input. That was kind of beyond its capabilities. But that was like a tease of like being able to do this stuff that you were playing. But then what really got me into it was doing stuff on Mac, specifically the HyperCard stuff that we also did an episode about. But like the Manhole from Cyan is this big point-and-click adventure. And it was all done in HyperCard, which I had, you know, the program for, because it came on Macs then too. And I was looking at what it did and what you could do. And I was like, that was the first time I really had the notion I could do this. I mean, I can't do the graphics as the beautiful black and white graphics that they had, but I could like basically make this game. I could figure out how to do it. And I did. I made some similar games with not nearly as nice graphics. And that not that I'm saying that the stuff I made was actually as good as the Manhole. But very similar kinds of things. I could make a point and click adventure. I made some other stuff too. And that was really transformative. And got me into software. And, you know, now I've been a software engineer for like 25 years or something. And also following the games that you can make with software engineering. So yeah, that was probably my most transformative early experience with games that really sucked me into the whole cultural phenomena.
That's cool. You know, the TI-99-4A just turned 40 in June.
Oh, nice.
So I did a little article about it for How2Geek about the 40th anniversary, which is neat. You might enjoy that.
Yeah, its spokesman was recently let out of jail.
Well, I sort of underplayed that part of the history. Yes,
as he wisely should have. Anyway, here's a letter from J.A. Pinheiro from Tao Baja, Puerto Rico. The game that made me fall in love with gaming has to be Shining Force on the Game Gear. I always enjoyed watching older brother and cousins play Street Fighter and Contra, but those were just action fighting games. I'd seen them play Kung Fu, Duck Hunt, and Mario Brothers on NES, and I was always enthralled by the flashiness of it all. But video games didn't seem that deep. One Christmas, I received a Game Gear with a handful of games. Yes, Sonic and Power Rangers were fun, but by then I preferred reading to playing games or watching cartoons. Shining Force was the first game I was invested in the story of, and the RPG tactics side would be the foundation that made me into a lifelong Pokemon fan. That was the twist I didn't expect at the end.
I totally understand that. I totally get it. Yeah. Because, like I said, Mario RPG was the first RPG that I really got into. And in fact, like in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was one of the first games that I played on an emulator and, like, replayed all the way through. But after getting into, like, Final Fantasy VII and Final Fantasy IX, like, around the turn of the century, the only RPGs that I really stuck with were Pokemon games. Like, I played Gold when I was in high school, when it came out in, like, 98. And then I came back with Heart Gold and have played all of them since. And, like, that's... Until, like, literally 3 weeks ago... 4 weeks ago, that was the RPG that I played, like the video game RPG that I played.
What's the new one?
I'm into Persona now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So if someone could explain Persona 1 through 4 to me, that would be great.
There's demons and you have to like fight them and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
And in some of the games, totally in some of the games you make friends with people in addition to the demons.
Yeah, that's good.
There's a pharmacy. I don't know.
There's a pharmacy?
It's even got its own theme song.
June's, cool. Yeah. But no, yeah, for me, the RPG turning point, I'm sure this is extremely non-controversial, was the Final Fantasy 2, nay 4. But that was really the one that got me into playing RPGs for like the next decade more than anything else.
I grinded Dragon Warrior nonstop for several years.
It's called Dragon Quest now.
Well, it wasn't back then, not in America. So my brother came along one day, loaded up my game, and he's like, "Man, you're level 50, but you haven't beat the first monster, you know, boss guy or whatever." I didn't know you had to do that. Curb-stomped him. Yeah, I didn't know how to get to him or what to do. I just would just play it and just fight the guys over and over again because I thought it was fun and I liked the music.
That happened to me in Final Fantasy VII, where I had that one materia that you can like learn a skill from a monster. And so I had this one monster, and a friend of mine told me, like, if you can get this, like the thing that he does, then you'll have a really easy time. And so I just like would die fighting that monster over and over until I finally survived and got it. Which I don't like being challenged in video games. I don't understand people who are like, "Oh, I want this to be more difficult." Not me. I want to crush every new thing that stands in my way.
I have a flashback of one of our first episodes we did together, Chris, where we may have been talking about Metroidvanias or something, and we both agreed that we loved Symphony of the Night and Metroidvanias because you could level up and get more powerful to actually make the game easier for you, you know.
Yeah.
And I did that. I was like level 50 on Symphony of the Night when I started progressing, because I didn't mind grinding in that game.
I remember having the thought, like when I was younger, and this would have been like around the time of like me playing FF10 or something, where I was like, I had the thought, and I no longer think this is correct before anyone writes in. I was like, "Oh, you can't actually be good at JRPGs. You just have to be persistent."
That's why the Shin Megami Tensei series exists, to disabuse you of that notion.
Well, I was playing, I've been playing also because I had to take a trip and I couldn't take my PS5 with me to continue playing Persona. I was playing Tokyo Mirage Sessions FE Sharp Encore.
You got it all right. Good job.
Yeah, that's a heck of a title. And there's a part in that that game where like you can just go in and grind. It's like a little room that you go into. And every time you defeat a monster, you fight a stronger one, and they all drop things that give you more experience. Huh. And there's a little notice on the game that was like, "Hey, remember though, if you do this too much, it might make the combat in the rest of the game not as fun." And I was like, "You don't know what I consider fun, video game."
Yeah, I mean, people grind differently. I know I've had heated debates or discussions with Shivam Butt, who has been a contributor to a lot of Retronauts episodes, about how he plays Final Fantasy V, where once he gets any set of crystals that gives him new jobs to learn, he immediately goes out and masters every single one of those jobs for all of his characters. He just grinds. There's like places where you can grind and just do the same thing over and over again. Like that basement where there's the statues level is a multiple of 5, so you can use level 5 death on them and just wipe them out in a single action. Yeah. So, you know, I find that that approach is just interminable to me. I can't imagine playing like that, but some people really enjoy it. That's what they want to do. And, you know, that's cool. I like when video games give people the opportunity to do things in a different way. I'm not a big fan of games that are like, "We, the developers, have a single path for you to get through this game, figure out what we're thinking, do the things we want you to do in the exact order that we have prescribed without telling you, and you can finish this game." That's why I don't like the Advance Wars series.
I feel like that's the reason that I'm always going to prefer the Metroidvanias that are more like the Castlevania than the Metroids, because Metroids, you have a set like progression through the game where your increase in abilities and your increase in like health and power is tied to how far you are in the game. Whereas the post Symphony of the Night Castlevania structure is, if you're patient and you like playing it, you can get as strong as you want whenever you want. And I like that. Like as long as it's fun to do. And I think that's the trick that Symphony of the Night and like Dawn of Sorrow and Aria of Sorrow do better than a lot of other games, is they make that process really engaging and fun.
I will say that the Metroids have one advantage over the Vanias, which is that at the time of this recording session, they're still making Metroids and not Vanias.
Yeah, there is that.
But, you know, there's Bloodstained.
Yeah.
They're making another one of those.
Bloodstained's good, actually. It would be nice if it ran well on the Switch. That's all.
Maybe they'll get that with the second one.
Yeah. I got stuck in it somewhere and I just couldn't figure out where to go and I gave up. I don't know. I wanted to love it.
Playing it for the third time, really, I
really broke it.
Not a joke. I genuinely loved it a ton. Sitting down to play it to review it.
I'll give it another shot.
All right. Well, here is a letter from Juha Holm. The game that made me love video games is the Commodore 64 version of Capcom's Commando. Very specific. I was born in 84, so I didn't play it when it was new, and it wasn't until sometime in 1990 or 91 when my family got a used C64 with a ton of copied games. I'm Finnish and didn't understand English at that age, so I initially only played the more arcadey stuff, and among those, Commando really stood out to me. It looked great, played great, and had great music. The C64 version is very short, as it only has 3 levels, but that didn't bother me, as I had never played any other versions, so I didn't even know something was missing. I've since played the arcade game, both emulated and on original hardware, but it's just not the same without the Rob Hubbard music. That is a European-ass answer. Alejandra from Monterrey, Mexico says, "My answer is boring, because it's simple and predictable for someone my age. Mario, Mario, Mario. I was born in 1985, so my earliest gaming memories include the tail end of the NES days, but we had an Atari before my dad bought an NES circa 1989. So I do remember playing Pitfall, that terrible Pac-Man port, although there is someone, Alejandro, who'd like to have words with you about that. A Cookie Monster game and an assortment of sports carts on the 2600. But it wasn't until I saw Super Mario Brothers running on a cousin's NES that I was blown away. It caused me to beg for that console to my dad. It's 3 games that changed my life and made me realize I'd be playing games forever. Super Mario Bros. 1 made me look and see how games could be more than single-screen point fests. Super Mario 3 cemented my love by losing me in this world I didn't want to get out from. And Super Mario 64 showed me I'd never grow to be too old to be amazed by video games. To this day, I consider Super Mario Bros. 3 the best game ever made."
Not an incorrect answer.
I feel like it's not a controversial thing to say.
It's certainly, like, adjusting for any limitations of hardware. Yeah. Like, they don't get a lot better than that one.
I agree.
The world maps in that game just are so good.
Yeah. It'll always be good. It'll always be a great game.
I'm also a little sad that even when Mario goes back to the, like, stage map, well, they're never as fun as Mario 3. So, yeah,
like there's I don't think people talk about it a lot, and maybe this is just me not being aware of it, but like climbing up the tower in World 5 to get into the clouds is such a clever trick and such awesome. A like brilliant move for that game. Yeah. It's the kiss awesome. Of a chef. Beautiful.
Mario has been a chef. Yoshi's Cookie.
That's true.
I love Yoshi's Cookie.
There you go. Paul from Leeds in the UK says, "Sonic the Hedgehog has caused some video game hate in his 30 years of existence, but he's also what made me fall in love with them. The first game had such an impact on me as a kid that I became a Sonic fan for life. I played the games, watched the cartoons, read the comics, and even ate the Sonic pasta shapes. I followed the blue guy to the Saturn and Dreamcast." Saturn? What? "And then when Sega left the hardware business, I ended up buying all subsequent Nintendo, PlayStation, and Xbox machines, catching up on a lot of games I'd missed in the process. Sega consoles died, so my love for video games could live."
That's not why they died.
Is it not?
Yeah, it's a shame.
I'm pretty sure that was the business rationale.
So that
we want Paul from Leeds in the UK to be able to enjoy video games.
Okay.
It was very noble.
It was a
noble
sacrifice.
Here is a letter from Hassan, who says simply, "Space Harrier, the original sit-down arcade cabinet. I was about 8 years old when I saw it first, and it's the reason I chose a Master System over an NES a couple of years later, when we were visiting from the States. When we were visiting the States from the UK. No regrets." So, yeah, there's something... What?
None?
Evidently not.
Okay, no, look, I'm...
About that purchase, I think, is what he's saying.
All right.
Like, he probably has regrets in life, because who doesn't? But no regrets for having purchased a Master System to play Space Harrier over buying an NES.
Okay.
Because Space Harrier, actually a better game than 3D World Runner. That was what the NES could offer.
I love 3D World Runner.
It was okay, but it was no Space Harrier.
I like it better than Space Harrier. I don't know. I played it. I played both with the 3D shutter glasses. Isn't that the one with the shutter glasses?
3D World Runner?
No. Well, on the Sega Master System, doesn't Space Harrier support the shutter
glasses? I want to say yes, but I might be lying.
Yeah, I think it is. And the 3D World Runner has the red blue.
Red blue man.
Things, but anyway, they're both cool.
Space Harrier, when you die, you go, and the guy kind of like flies up in the air and then falls off the screen.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Sega Master
I love
System.
Video game deaths.
We should do a Master System episode.
We should do a video game deaths episode.
Sega always had the best deaths. They always gave you like the little angel floating up with a halo. Like that was a thing Sega did, and it's like people have chronicled, like documented how many Sega games have that in it. It was a thing for them. It was really great.
Yeah.
All right, this went in a really strange direction. Let's steer back on track with a letter from Tom Hewlett. Space Invaders was my first game, and I loved the medium immediately. My parents had apparently bought into the Atari hype years earlier, but the 2600 was collecting dust in a closet somewhere. One rainy afternoon in kindergarten, I was upset we couldn't go outside, so she decided to bring it out to see if games might calm me down. I guess I'm pretty chill, 35 years and a lifelong career later.
I remember when I was younger, this was in the 90s, would have been 94, 95, and I had a magazine. It was like the top 50 video games of all time, and Doom's not number one. And the number one that they picked was Space Invaders.
Wow, really? EGM did a great 100 best video games in like 96 or something. I really loved that list, probably because they picked Super Metroid as number two, I think Tetris was number one.
I remember that list.
Like that, so.
I was like, hell yeah, you guys. What's up? What's up?
That was great. Yeah. I wrote Crispin Boyer an email way back then, and said that you guys did a great job. And he said, thanks. So,
good old Crispin.
Yeah. The other thing I discovered exists recently, being in a few weird arcades like the place at Myrtle Beach, is the giant two-player Space Invaders with like light guns. That has like
I've played that.
It has like waves of giant Space Invaders going across this huge vertically oriented screen, and you're just shooting them with basically light guns, like rapid fire style.
That's the thing where they're
and it's
mounted,
like pixels everywhere.
The
mounted guns.
I played that.
I don't even know where this came from, but I've seen it like twice in the last year.
Have you played the world's largest Pac-Man that's in some of those arcades? It's a giant like LED board that's like 10 feet tall and has a joystick in the middle. It's really fun. It's basically
a big joystick,
Pac-Man.
Like a beach ball.
That would be fun.
It's a life-size Pac-Man that you have to steer around.
What is life-size for Pac-Man?
3 foot
You'd be
diameter.
Surprised.
It's Puck size, isn't it?
Puck.
Because he was a
He's
Puck
tiny?
Man.
That means they're little ghosts.
Maybe like Puck from Alpha Flight?
Mm. That makes a little more sense.
I think that works.
Yeah.
Okay. And I was speaking Chris's language.
Yeah.
I have an existential question for you guys. This is slightly off topic. But this is...
Should I be charging by the hour for this?
Yeah. Yeah, my whole life I've seen sports commentators and sports shows and stuff. They're talking about sports and sports this, sports that, and sports ball and sports ball two, and all the sequels. And they talk about, stuff I don't understand. I mean,
sorry, I'm just thinking about the sequel to sports.
Sports ball two. Sports two.
Yeah.
Sports anyway, two. So are we those guys for video games? Are we those people who talk about something so esoteric to everyone else they can't understand what we're talking about?
That's why we rake in the big bucks, man.
That's what every podcast is.
I just never, the funny thing is I asked my wife, have you listened to Retronauts? And she's like, no, I don't understand half of what you're saying.
I mean, sports people are nerds too. They're just nerds for a different thing.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think was misunderstood for a long time, is that people who memorize sports statistics and can tell you what the ERA of X pitcher was, 30 seasons ago, like they are every bit as dorky and socially awkward as we video game people are. It's just that, what they're obsessing over involves large athletic men getting paid a lot of money, whereas our work involves like nerds in a basement. So there's like a little
not
more of a...
Not as athletic people getting paid a lot of money.
I mean, sometimes. Some YouTubers are in pretty good shape and making a lot of cash, but yes.
That's not who we're talking about, though. We're talking about
some developers.
My close personal friend, Mario.
Right, Mario. He's nimble.
He's got
nimble.
Cardio. Yeah.
He's been to the Olympics a bunch.
I know, right? And he can compete against Sonic, who, like, all he does is just run fast. So he's doing okay.
Do they have, like, track events in those games? I've never played a Mario and Sonic yet. Like,
there's an entire Mario and Sonic track and field
game. Yeah, no, what I'm saying is, like, why, though? Because we know who should win that.
It's true.
That'd be like Mario versus a car.
They have to tape lid to Sonic's feet for it to be fair. Yeah, it's a handicap.
I mean, I'd be very curious in, like, other sports. I don't know, like, javelin?
Mario mostly throws shells forward. Like, when he throws it up, he actually has to kick it. It only goes a little ways. That's true. So, I don't know about...
Well, he can throw stuff in, like, the 3D
Yoshi
games.
Yoshi.
Well, wait, the hammers. I mean, hammer suit.
The hammer throws.
He chucks those hammers.
That is true. Anyway, what were we talking about? Oh, yeah. I hadn't actually said what game made me love video games. And not to be too obvious here, but it was Donkey Kong. I remember seeing that in the arcades early on and just being entranced by it because the visuals were so interesting compared to other games of the era. It had this huge monkey character at the top of the screen, plus a little guy who was running back and forth. He could jump. He could hit stuff with a hammer. It was great. There were multiple screens, like mostly. At the time, I was 5, 6. I could only see that first screen because the game was hard. It was too hard for my tiny little underdeveloped brain. But then I would watch the big kids play, and they would get to, you know, the elevator level. Sometimes they would even get to the pie factory stage.
Wow.
Which, you know, later I learned out it was not pies. But, it, you know, it was just enticing.
What are they?
They're cement pies.
Cement factory,
Yeah, we call it the pie factory.
That's why there is a Game & Watch game called Mario's Cement Factory. And not an LCD game called Mario's Pie Factory.
It's a shame.
He didn't become a baker until Yoshi's Cookie. We talked about this earlier.
Yeah. I should have been keeping notes.
I feel like there's an underrated part of Donkey Kong, which is right at the beginning when he climbs up the thing and then stomps on it and that makes the level. That's a really cool touch.
That is.
He's on a construction site and he's like, F you construction workers, I'm messing up all your hard work and skewing these girders.
Yeah. That's cool.
It is cool.
That's really cool.
Then to defeat him, you actually have to undo all your work on the top level of the skyscraper. You have to pull out the bolts and make the whole thing collapse. Oh, yeah. So counterproductive.
I was just going to say, Donkey Kong was influential to me too on that, but it is the Atari 800 port. There's something about the character of Mario that was very personable and detailed at a time when most of the like protagonists in those games were little stick figures, even on the Atari 800.
The Running Man.
So, yeah, he had some detail to him, and it was, you know, it was a great port by Landon Dyer, is his name. And the coolest thing about growing up and finding the internet was that I found his website and emailed him and said, hey, I loved your port of Donkey Kong, you know, like 2006 or something. And he was like, man, thanks, you know, I'll tell you how I made it and stuff. And it was great. That's the fulfillment of one's life dreams or something.
You need to write to more game developers, I guess.
It is the coolest thing. It is the coolest thing to, like, I never thought I would grow up and talk to Woz or something, because I idolized Steve Wozniak, you know, or talk to John Romero or something. You know, it's just incredible. And, you know, it's not that I'm special, although it is. It's also that it's that anyone can do it. These people are accessible. They're out there, and they love it. Creators love it when you tell them that you love what they've created. You know?
Yeah, I work on the basic assumption that people think I'm an asshole and that I would just annoy them if I bothered them. So I never do that.
Who do you want to talk to that you've been too shy about?
All of them. Everyone.
Man. I can't, like, I feel like there's a Japanese barrier that I can't break, which is unfortunate because I love so many Japanese games. But on the American side, if you can find somebody who's made a really awesome sort of obscure game, you know, write to them and tell them. If you can find them, you know, tell them how much you love it because it will make their day and make their life. I mean, it is amazing.
I wonder what the Miller brothers are up to now. They were relaunching some online Myst thing at some point, but I don't remember where that went.
I don't know. Yeah. They were, yeah. They've seemed like they've been keeping busy with stuff. I've never talked to them, though, but I love Myst.
I did talk to Robin Miller at GDC like a decade ago. Then the site got shut down, so I didn't get to publish it.
Oh, man.
Very cool.
Oh.
Anyway, that's not why I love video games, because of layoffs and corporate mergers. It's because of the video games and the cool experiences, just the memorable stuff. So, yeah. Anyway, this was a fun, low-key kind of episode. I actually think, you know, your sports ball question, in this case, this episode is the opposite of that. I think this was a very relatable episode. I think So many of the opinions and experiences we talked about and the letters we read were super relatable to a lot of people. You know, everyone who enjoys a thing, they always have this moment where they realize, like, this is something I like. I want more of this.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's going to vary from every person from one to the other. But I think the fundamental mechanisms and the triggers in our brains, even if you can't relate to the specific game or experience that someone had, you can say, like, oh, something like that happened to me too. So, this was interesting because, yeah, just hearing kind of these experiences that are not shared experiences, but somewhat common between so many people was really enjoyable. There's still a ton of letters, so I might have to revisit this topic with another group of people just to, you know, have the excuse to read all these letters, because they were all great. And I only read like half of them. So thanks everyone who wrote in. Even if I did not have a chance to read your letter on this podcast, there were a lot of letters, but I promise that those won't go to waste. We will use every last scrap.
Not for fire.
Jeez, for podcasts. Content.
I'm already crumpling them up right now. Just kidding.
This is what happens when we give binge gin.
They're not actually paper people out there. I was about to say kids. Kids.
All right.
You can't actually burn them.
So, yes. Thanks, everyone, for writing in. Thanks, you guys, for sharing your particular memories. And I think we're going to wrap it up here for hopefully not the final episode of Retronauts East in its current configuration, but I don't know. Things have changed a lot over the past few years. We're all in different places in life than when we first started recording together. I'd say all of us are in better places, actually.
We're a lot taller, too.
Speak for yourself. I've actually gotten smaller, shorter.
Oh, man.
It's very sad. They keep coming at night and compressing me in my sleep. It's terrible. I don't know.
It's like the worst possible thing you can imagine.
A lot of JPEG artifacts on Jeremy Parrish right now.
So there's some people with clamps who break into your bedroom every night and crush it's you awful. Slowly.
Yes. Positive, I'm terrible. Sure of it.
That's a terrible thing.
Anyway, so thanks again, everyone, for listening. And if you enjoyed this freewheeling casual conversation about video games and found it relatable, you may be able to relate to other episodes of Retronauts, of which we publish like 6 or 7 a month. So you can find those at Retronauts.com and on the Greenlit Podcast Network and various and sundry other podcasting devices and platforms. But you can also go to Retronauts or Patreon.com/Retronauts and support the show for $3 a month. You get every episode we publish on Mondays, a week early, at a higher bitrate quality, with no advertisements, etc. And if you bump that pledge to $5 a month, you also get bi-weekly patron-exclusive episodes on every other Friday, as well as a mini podcast by Diamond Fight every weekend. You get Discord access. There's a lot of stuff that you can do and see and get for your support for the show. And this show is pretty much just made possible through Patreon, so your support is appreciated. Anyway, that is my pitch for you. Now I will let others here make their pitches as well. Benj, how about you?
You can find me on Twitter at Benj Edwards, and come join in my weird retro adventures, and you can read the latest things I write for How To Geek, and I'm still making joysticks a little bit on the side. So if you really want a BX110 or something, which is my Super NES style stick, just let me know. And Ben?
I'm Ben Elgin. I have no pitch, unless you need a CNC milling machine, which you probably don't.
I do.
Well, okay, yeah, Bench does. But you can find me on Twitter at Kirin, K-I-R-I-N-N, and sometimes I actually tweet things other than what beer I was drinking, but sometimes not.
I'm Chris Sims, and you can find me by going to my website, which is the-isb.com. I do a lot of things. I do a lot of podcasts that you can listen to. If you like what I have to say on this one. And I've also written a bunch of stuff, but the only thing that I'm writing right now that is publicly available is actually my series of Metroidvania reviews called Castlemania, which I'm doing as a Patreon exclusive for the War Rocket Ajax Patreon, where I am ranking every Metroidvania I have ever and will ever play.
Many of his opinions are bad and wrong. It's great.
Yeah, that's what I hear from Jeremy Parrish, who refuses to read them.
Anyway, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, the person who gives Chris Sims flack, on Patreon. You can find me on Patreon. Sure, go for it. I appreciate your support for my video projects. But you can find me on Twitter as GameSpite, and you can find me doing stuff at Limited Run Games. That's my day job. And you can find me on, what's this podcast? Oh, that's right, Retronauts. So, yeah, that's about it. Anyway, we all are people who have been indoctrinated into the world of video games. We like them. We may even love them. And we are going to talk more about them. But for now, that's it. This episode is over.
Bring Nestor back on Twitch.